Blog Talk Radio.
By a group out of Las Vegas called Zingaya. Well, tonight our special show highlights the work of two special women. The first up in just a few minutes is Jin In. She's the founding director and president of an organization called Four Girls Global Leadership. And our topic is going to be how the world's poorest girls can save our world and ourselves. Her organization pairs up American women who have a deep yearning to find purpose, meaning, and interconnection with girls and women in developing world, with local young women in poor countries who then impact girls who are maybe marginalized, exploited, or not really valued. Then following Jin, we have returning to the show the beloved Selena Fox from Circle Sanctuary. She hasn't been on the show for a while, so I'm glad to have her back. She needs little in the way of introduction. She's going to be discussing Yuletide goddesses and pagan studies. She's going to tell us how to work with the divine feminine at Yuletide and share with us traditions and symbols from the past that continue to be celebrated today. We'll also talk about the upcoming Contemporary Pagan Studies Conference that's going to be held at Claremont University in Claremont, California in January. Selena is going to be one of the keynote speakers there, along with Patrick McCullum, and I'm happy to say I'm actually one of the presenters there as well. The topic for the conference is going to be community building. So with two guests like that, there's not going to be a whole lot of time for the What's the Buzz segment tonight, but there are a couple new developments I want to make sure you're aware of because they've just sort of become on our radar screen. The first is Blog Talk has given all of the folks with the show notice that in 2 weeks the structure is going to change. You might not have realized, but people like myself, we do the show free of charge. For me, it's a dedication and service to the community because I care about empowering women and making sure people understand what the feminine consciousness and right brain thinking is all about, who goddess advocates are, and you know how these new values and benchmarks could change the world. So, you know, I think that's an important subject. So, you know, I've been dedicating the last 3 years to the show, and I have been having a wonderful time. And you know, my compensation is just the sheer joy. This is my guilty pleasure. However, even though there's no compensation for the show, all this time the show had been free. We have been able to use the airtime at Blog Talk without it costing us anything. Well, that's going to change. We got 2 weeks' notice that starting at the beginning of the year, if we want to keep our shows the way they are and not limit them to a 30-minute segment, which, you know, you can hardly say hello and goodbye in 30 minutes, they're going to start charging us. So, long story short, our radio show is looking for a sponsor. Or if you're interested in sending donations, if the show is important to you, that would be helpful. So you can contact me privately at KarenTate108@ca.rr.com. And fortunately, the amount that they're going to start charging us is not a lot. It's only $30 a month. But once they start charging us, there will probably be no end in sight. So if you care about the show, if you're one of our family, if you want to make sure, you know, the show doesn't go away or we get, you know, priced out of the market, because like I said, I don't, you know, I do this as a service. I don't get paid to do this. We would appreciate, you know, the listeners supporting the show. So, I feel like I'm PBS or something. If you like what you've been listening to and you want it, you know, you want it to be here for you every week, please, you know, what you support and nurture grows, and what you neglect withers. So please think about becoming a sponsor or possibly donating to cover the cost of the show. The second thing I wanted to share with you, I thought was really important. It came out recently in the Washington Post. Many of you know Starhawk. She's known around the world. Well, she's the co-founder of Reclaiming. She's a prominent voice in the modern neo-pagan spirituality family, I guess you could say, or movement. She's the co-founder of Reclaiming.org. She's an activist. She's political. She's spiritual. And she's probably the author of over 10 books. Anyway, you might want to know that she actually came out against the idea of the Obama tax cut. She said the rich benefit from society and should give back. She said in a time of economic turmoil and record poverty levels, are tax cuts for the wealthy moral? And she answers thus. She says, in a time of massive unemployment, huge deficits, and falling income for the middle class and the poor, tax cuts for the wealthy are a form of legalized theft. In the last decades, we have seen an unfathomable transfer of wealth from the poor and middle classes to the rich. The income gap has grown astronomically. Middle class income has not risen in 30 years, while the speculators and the loan sharks who are responsible for this current crisis still get their inflated bonuses. A couple other of her quotes in the article I think worth mentioning is, we are all interconnected. That is the core teaching of the goddess traditions and of indigenous and earth-based spirituality, as well as the underlying moral principle and religions of the book and the basic insight of the ecological sciences. We are all interdependent. Your well-being supports mine. If you go hungry, how can I in good conscience feast? And finally, she says, the rich benefit from society and should give back. Moral people give back. Moral people care for others, sharing both wealth and burdens. Moral people ask, what more can I, I'm sorry, let me rephrase that. Moral people ask not, what more can I take from society, but what more can I contribute? So I think it's awesome that a neo-pagan leader has come out and taken such a stand. You can find that in the Washington Post, because she's one of the contributors, along with a lot of other traditional faith people who write a column called On Faith. So you can go there and look at it yourself. It's also on my Facebook page if you'd like to go there and read the article in its entirety. I'd also like to offer thanks to one of my regular listeners who emailed me today. Her name is Saruji. Saruji wrote, I've been in a Masters of Sustainability program since August and just wanted to take a minute to say how fundamental I found the last two broadcasts. Of course, the others are wonderful, and I guess for where I am in my life, these last two really resonated with me. Thank you so very much. Well, thank you, Saruji. That is gas in my tank. A couple of you wrote asking me to repeat the quote I read last week as I discussed, you know, my dedication to seeking knowledge and sharing new ideas. That quote went like this. Here it is. Hang on. All truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it's accepted for being self-evident. and that's from the 19th century German philosopher, author Schopenhauer. And if you like that one, how about this one? I think actually Gandhi said it. These two quotes could actually be mottos for our show. Here's this one. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. So thank you, Gandhi. And finally, with the holidays upon us, I especially want to thank you for tuning in during what is probably an extremely busy time. So whether you're catching us live tonight or if you catch us from the archives, I'm just glad you're here with us. And please remember the three Fs. I'd love it if you would mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite. Be sure to become our friend and click on follow. That's the three Fs. Favorite, friend, and follow. That way you'll never miss notice of new guests each week. That way you're a part of our growing family of listeners across the globe. And you do all of that from my show page that pops up when you go on to Blog Talk and find Voices of the Sacred Feminine. And please remember, tell your friends, there is now a link on my website that takes you to the itinerary for the sacred tour I'll be leading to Turkey, Land of the Nourishing Mothers, next November. I'm taking both men and women on the trip. We'll be going to places like Ephesus, Çatalhöyük, Legina, Side, Istanbul. We'll be doing activities like dream incubations, rituals. We'll partake of Turkish baths and mineral baths near the domain of Aphrodite's temple outside Aphrodisias. So if you're hearing the call for a sacred journey, if you'd like to satisfy your mind, your body, or your soul, just go to my website. All the information is there, KarenTate.com. And people are already signing up, and we're only taking 20. So this is just a reminder, if you're seriously thinking about this, better to sign up sooner rather than later, because I'm sure the trip will fill long before November. And while you're there at KarenTate.com, and since we have so many new listeners from across the globe, please check out my two books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. I think they're great bookends. They make great holiday gifts. They have garnered prestigious endorsements, and I have won awards. And I have a special for radio show listeners, so that's all there on the website as well. And I have freebies there at the Goddess Store. You can go and check out the free meditations and download those and use them at your convenience. And don't forget, if you're listening live and want to call in to talk to my fabulous guests or myself, the number is 718-766-4662. I know a lot of you listen from the archives, but if you want to call in, when I see you on the switchboard, I will get to you when we have a lapse in the conversation, and I'll identify you by your area code. So, without further delay, I want to thank Jin In for her patience, but let me tell you a little bit about her before we start our chat. Jin In is Eastern-born, Western-bred, with a global vision of empowering the world's poorest girls as a powerful lever to make our world better. She's the founding director and president of 4Girls Global Leadership. That website, if you want to check it out, is the number 4GGL.org. Jin created 4GGL because the suffering of millions of girls throughout the developing world is pandemic. At the root is not valuing girls, which she knows because she's lived that life. A native of South Korea, born into a wealthy family, Jin became instantly poor when her father died, and she received no inheritance simply because she was a girl. Prior to 4GGL, she created the first Girls Advisory Group for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Service Office on Women's Health, receiving a White House Award and programs ranking number one for girls' health information by Google, MSN, Yahoo, and AOL. She also led the highest Girls Leadership Awards at Girl Scouts USA Global Action Department. Furthermore, she has worked in collaboration with over 1,000 NGOs at the UN to advocate for the world's girls. She was the 2010 Cordis Fellow, Opportunity Collaboration, and 2007 Woman Leader for the World, Global Women Leadership Network. Also, she was awarded the 2010 Global Citizenship Award for Leadership in Helping Humanity by Orphans International Worldwide, the 2008 Women's Social Leadership Award by BT Executive Women, and in 2006 named 100 Young Women for Making a Difference in the World. Wow, Jen, you have been incredibly busy doing incredible work.
Thank you, Karen. Thanks for having me on the show. It really is an honor to be able to share a life calling that I feel very passionate about. But as you gave a brief overview of the things that's coming up, I totally see why I'm on the show. It really is about bringing the spirituality of women and the powerful potential now that also now must be transcended to girls who have never been valued and who've never been recognized. And quite honestly, as someone once said, the disposable population.
Absolutely. And you know what? The reality is, you know, women do most of the work in the world and have the least amount of assets. It's women and children who are always at the margins of society with the least education, the least, health care. I mean, and women are the life givers, you know, and young girls, they are the future life givers. And our world is just really turned upside down, and it needs to be righted. It's as if at some point when patriarchy took over, the world was just turned upside down and on its head, and what is natural and right and just just really went out the window.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because so many people do fight for equities and equality and justice, but gender inequity cross-cuts all of those inequities. So it's a huge problem.
Well, and I think, you know, I'm a firm believer. I mean, I'm not, you know, an official sociologist, but I've talked to a lot of people, studied a lot, listened, you know, that kind of thing. It seems like to me it's our religions that really sort of give people license to do this sort of thing. I mean, when Jimmy Carter comes out and says he's leaving the Baptist Church because of, you know, how the Bible oppresses women, I mean, we see it in a lot of all of our male-dominated religions. You know, women are always below men. You know, you look right now, people are using the Bible as an excuse for corrective rape, or we're talking Sharia law, you know, for Muslims. Women really, they're sort of the brunt of a lot of abuse, and it's not something you can quantify, but it feels like to me, they're the ones that bear the brunt of the world's suffering.
Right, and that's really the reason why I call the world suffering, or the suffering that girls endure, is pandemic. This is, gender inequity happens in every corner of our world. So it happens in the United States, and we don't have to look very far to really see it right here in United States as well. But when you're talking about such gross injustice, 100 million girls are not alive today because they were killed before they were born, or as they were fetuses, they were killed. 100 million girls, again, they married underage in the next 10 years, and half the sexual violence that happens, and we're not talking about, someone who might be sexually harassing you, although that's also injustice as well, but we're talking about gross rape in DRC and, what they might call ethnic cleansing or HIV/AIDS. There's a myth that goes on that says that if you rape a girl or if you have a sex with a virgin, then your HIV status is cured. And, I mean, just all sorts of craziness that you hear about. So when such a horrific atrocities are happening pandemically, it really is waking a lot of people up. And sadly, it's waking people up because it's coming to their backyard.
Yeah.
So some of the places that I work in, like Pakistan, I don't really know if people really would see the girls that are suffering there as, we should really help. But because they see terrorism right in our backyard, that, they're paying attention. And when we talk about really the interconnection and the work that I do, this is macroeconomics. I get to talk to people like the World Bank and some really powerful institution, because and this is truth, there's been proof, and we can show numbers and statistics that show if you give a dollar or money to women and girls, that 90% goes back to the community. If you give it to a man or boy, at best, 35% goes back to the community.
Well,
so
you know, we saw that
powerful
in Haiti.
Number shows. Go ahead.
We saw that in the clips, you know, coming back from Haiti right after the earthquake, when, you know, relief workers were trying to hand out food, and the men pushed themselves to the front, grabbed up all the food in the beginning, and then went and tried to sell it. You know, where the women, you know, when the women get the food, well, then they go back home and they share it with the family. You know, it's
right.
Just it's a different mindset. And you know, and look, and I'm not a man basher. Sure, I have the most wonderful husband in the world, but you know, if there's just a difference in you know how you know how women are going to you know have a more nurturing outlook, and they're going to see how their actions affect the people around them. Where I think you know men tend to be a little bit more. I hate to say it, but maybe a little bit more self-centered. You know, they're sort of looking straight ahead. You know, a lot of times, not all men, of course, but it's more about me, I, as opposed to we, us. You know, I think women are a little bit more about, you know, we, us.
Right, exactly. And that's actually what this organization and the program is about. At the root of it all is about women's leadership. What does that look like? It really is the divine feminine. And when I even looked up the word leaders in every single language, the oldest language, Sanskrit, Chinese, it had a male connotation. So then my mentor said, go look up the word wisdom. And in every language, again, it had a female connotation. So then I chose the word that's most understandable, I think, to American women. So the foundation of our model, we call them Sophias, and Sophia is the Greek word for wisdom. So, you know, I joke about it because I say that even men hijack the word leader.
Well, now let's you know make sure our listeners understand this problem. I mean, you know, we've had people on the show talking about human trafficking, and I've had Vandana Shiva on talking about bride burning. You know, I mean, I've had somebody from Amnesty International talking about female genital mutilation, but. You know, from what do you see are some of the biggest injustices to women across the globe, and
right.
Girls?
Exactly. Well, I have been probably studying this and looking at it and working at different very one issue area at a time to really see there's actually a root cause for all of them. So whether it is child burning or bride burning or child marriage or whatever, at the end, it's because they're not valuing that person as a human being. And the truth of it is they're not valuing it because they're females. So, and it starts with just being a girl. And, of course, then that systematically and systemically, that girl lives out it throughout her life. So that's the reason why I also launched a social change movement to value and invest in the world's poorest girls. At the end, whatever we value, whether it's education, a house, a car, we will invest in it. So why is it that we're not investing in poor girls? So it became very obvious to me that had to be that was the root cause, and that we actually had to have a total change in paradigm. Then, of course, great leaders and scholars like Hillary Clinton, Amartya Sen, Wangari Maathai, great people who are working in international development have come out and said, at the root, it's because we don't value girls. So, you know, it's great when these scholars and leaders are also dittoing exactly what you said. But, you know, it was so obvious that until we target the root cause, we're going to just have enormous amounts of these symptoms, which was actually getting worse and worse. You know, we're not just talking about girls who aren't able to go to school. We're talking about they're killed just because they're a girl, or they're punished just because they're a girl. And so many of the problems that exist today, my background is health, so I always naturally related to health. I studied medicine and looked at women's health. And, you know, when I worked for the Secretary of Health, the Surgeon General used to say that if I can give you a pill that would alleviate everything, you know, you could sleep better, you look better, you feel better, you know, even sex is better, but I told you it was free. Would you take it? And, you know, the whole crowd, everyone said, of course. Well, that's your lifestyle. And it's physical activity. And, you know, so it's really everything that has become such a great problem today are social phenomenon. So we can correct it. Sadly, it's also the hardest thing to correct because it's our human behavior. So all the things that we're seeing that women and girls are suffering, and I mean deathly suffering, is because of cultural and traditional norms that is punishing them just because they're one gender.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, it has become what you call it norms, but yeah, it has become normal. You know, it's as
right.
if, you know, it's almost institutionalized sexism, institutionalized discrimination, you know, institutionalized exploitation, and we don't think twice about it. You know,
That's
I think
correct.
We don't think
right.
twice about it because it's, well, if the church can exploit women, then I guess it must be okay kind of a thing, you know?
Right, absolutely. And people use, and I would say the number one justification is it is religion. And it's not just, you know, of course we had Christians killing women, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago as well. So it's not just one religion, it's really all religion
right,
that have
right.
that done it in the name of God. So, you know, it is quite interesting, and we call it gender empowerment because it really isn't just about helping women and girls, it's also empowering the men. And we see this phenomenon, and for me, with my organization, I also work with men. All the organizations, or most of the organizations that sign on and want to partner and have this training with me is men. Because without, you know, women have been working in this issue for so long and they called it women's issue. And I refuse to call it that. It's the world's issue. It's a
right.
humanitarian issue. So until
right.
we get men on board, there is no empowerment. And you know, it's so interesting when we see in places like DRC and where there's grave, you know, violence and war, when men are disempowered, the first thing they do is they go and beat up the women.
Right.
So,
somebody more vulnerable and weaker than
exactly.
them.
Exactly. That's
yeah.
exactly right. Right. So we do have to educate the men, and we do have to get them on board. And it is very interesting that when the time that I've worked on this issue, when you talk about their women, then it becomes victim and blaming. But when you're talking about the girl, even the men join, and they say, not to my daughter. So it is
why
a very
is that, you think,
interesting paradigm.
Why is that paradigm? Why is it not? I mean, of course, it shouldn't be okay for either. But why can they excuse it for women when they can't? But they say, not my daughter.
Well, I think because, and again, I don't know. We would have to study more about the men. But I think it's because, you know, and it's probably just human nature. It's us too. When it becomes, the more personal it becomes to us, we go through those stages like denial and blaming and, you know, all the things that isn't so nice to really change. But when it's really further down in what I call upstream instead of downstream, then they are looking at prevention and they're looking at their daughters as an investment and not as their wives that, you know, that has all sorts of power dynamics. And you know, actually, when they have given women money, so microfinance is one of the things that has really taken off with women in developing country. And at the beginning, there's a lot of backlash. They don't want their women empowered. They don't want their women financially stable. So there's so much backlash, and when they come home, they get more beaten. So the women are questioning, well, what good does this do in my life?
Right,
whereas
right.
when it's about girls and educating them and giving them leadership skills, it really is a change in conversation, and the men join in, and they also feel empowered.
Well, that's really interesting, and you know, and I'll just play amateur shrink here, and I have no idea whether this is true, but I'm as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking to myself, I wonder if the girls are of their loins, so to speak. You know, they're their flesh and blood, where their wife, well, you know, maybe they weren't necessarily a love match. You know, maybe they were just a marriage of convenience. And you know, maybe this woman is, it means little to him, you know, less to him, or you know, maybe she's just a sexual partner or something like that, you know, not really, you know, a partner of the heart, so to speak. Anyway, I'm just, you know, thinking out loud here, you know, about why, you know, they could care about the girls but not their wives.
Right. Yeah, it is quite interesting, I think, because this is the reason why I could go to these countries and talk about the girls, and it's well received, versus, you know, the women always say, well, if it was about me or if it was about empowering me, it would be a different conversation. And generally, the women don't even participate in the conversation. The places that I go, it's totally gender separated. So you either talk to the men and that's it, or you talk to the women and that's it.
Well,
we're not having together conversations.
So do you have trouble getting the men to even listen to you since you're a woman?
You know, that is very interesting. People ask me that all the time. No, I don't. I can sit at the table with the men, and I'm considered a Westerner. I can also sit at the table with people who don't like Americans because they think I'm Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And I could sit at the table with women because I'm a woman. And I can also sit at the table with girls because that's obviously who I advocate for. So my friend jokes about it, and he says, well, goodness, you just plugged yourself in anywhere. And I think, you know, whatever, this is my calling, and it does work for me everywhere I go, which has been a blessing because, again, I don't go to places that is so nice like Venice or Paris. I'm going to places like Pakistan and Afghanistan and some places that Americans are certainly not very well received.
Right. Well, and I'm thinking too, although I hate to see the wives and the women in some cases not benefiting so much as the girls, but I guess you look at it from the standpoint of, well, the girls are the next generation. You know, if you get them on the right track, well, they're going to raise their daughters better, and they are going to be the next generation of wives and women who can then perpetuate this.
Right. Actually, so our model is a triad or three level. And so we have the American women at Sophia's. They train the local young women, and then the local young women train or provide mentorship to the girls. And most of those local young women are either teachers or community workers. So we're able to target. So by training a couple of trainers or a couple of schools, we can reach an impact of 50,000 girls or 100,000 girls. Which is the reason why I really realized, and only reason why I started an organization, or else I would have just gone around and tried to mentor one girl at a time. But I saw this need in such a scalable numbers that, and we had to do it quickly. And the reason why it also is getting some attention, and actually a lot of attention at this point, is because there are these goals that the UN set. The world leaders came together in 2000, and they wanted to slash all sorts of suffering by half. So they call it the Millennium Development Goals. They want to end hunger. They want to have universal education. They also want to increase gender equity, child health, maternal health, combating HIV/AIDS, and environmental sustainability. Well, when they looked at these goals, and we're not meeting any of them, and the deadline is 2015, literally developing girls' leadership for GGL targets all 8 of these goals. And it advances all of them. So it's such a powerful tool to be able to develop girls' leadership and realize that this really is the solution to poverty and extremism. I mean, this really is probably the only thing that I can go to Pakistan and talk to a religious leader or to a Taliban leader because, again, these are their girls. They don't want their girls hurt. So everybody is on board. So this is, you know, I say this is like the magic bullet. And thus trying to go and clone myself and get more global trainers so that, because this has really been asked by so many organizations across South Asia and Africa, that right now we already have requests that's able to reach over 500,000 girls.
Wow. Well, you know, connect the dots a little bit for my listeners. How is doing what you're doing maybe a solution to poverty or especially extremism?
Sure. So what we right now, today, we have the world's largest youth population, and most of them are living in developing countries. So when you have any problem, whether it's poverty or whether it's extremism, especially extremism, and they're poor, they don't have any problem signing on to the terrorist group. And in fact, that's their meal ticket. You know, the world, with so much inequity in the world, we would be fools, people who live in developed country, to think, oh, this isn't going to impact my life. Because inequity, it will come to your life, and it spreads everywhere. And the more gap there is in inequity, the more violent people become. So especially
in the United States.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And actually, the United States has the most economic gap in any developed nation. So there is a reason why there's so much violence in this country as well. So when this happens and the men are all angry and violent and they're poor and half of the population is marginalized and disempowered, there is going to be no growth, there's going to be no prosperity, and the poverty is only going to get worse. So by developing girls' leadership, it really is benefiting the community, and it is also the number one way to really combat these extremism. The girls,
well, you know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to quickly, it's really the girls and the mothers that once girls have education, they're not going to have children who then sign up for extremist groups. And
yeah.
Same thing with mothers. They're definitely not going to get their sons to sign up for extremist groups. So this has really been Nicholas Kristof, who is a New York Times columnist. He also launched a Half the Sky movement, which he targets actually three specific issues. And he says that empowering women and girls is the solution to poverty and extremism, and I've actually seen it.
Well, and I'm thinking too, you know, this idea of, you know, if you really want to win the hearts and minds of people, you certainly don't do it with bullets and bombs. You do it with schools and hospitals, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just common sense, you know, and anybody
right.
who says otherwise is either crazy or they're part of the military-industrial complex, you know. Let's get a little specific. Explain a little bit more about your three-tier structure and give us an example of what kind of things you'd go in and teach a girl in Pakistan or Afghanistan. Because, I've had people say they're practically living, you know, on the Stone Age level. I mean, that might be hyperbole or an exaggeration. I don't know. You tell me.
Right. Well, actually, a lot of that is probably not wrong. In fact, certain societies are going backwards, extremely backwards, because they are not given any education. When you're talking about a population where 4% of the women, 4% have a choice in who they marry, that's a problem. And when I give this talk to people, and that's Pakistan. In Pakistan, 4% of the girls and young women have a choice in their marriage. When I give this talk in Pakistan, the women say, who's those 4%? We like to see them. So meaning it's probably 100%. So when you're actually really talking about societies that actually used to be very civilized, go backwards, it is a scary thing, and we should not be surprised if it comes to our backyard, because really the world is so global. Women naturally understand that we're interconnected, and so that's actually the reason why I created this three-tier model. The women in the United States are realizing that they are recognizing their leadership potential by going to the developing country and igniting their own potential. So the women here, we train them as global trainers, the Sophias, then we go to the developing country to work with the local, let's say, educators or young women who then work with the girls.
So in other words, the people that the American women, okay, the American women get trained. They go, let's just say, Pakistan. They train people there on site who then keep training batches and batches of girls.
That's correct, right. And the girls already they work with them already as school teachers or as community workers. So, for example, one group we've partnered with in Nepal, they are a trekking company, but also they have a non-government organization side. So it's a little bit different. In most countries, actually in all the countries around the world, it's either government or non-government. Only the United States defines it by non-profit and for-profit. It's kind of funny how we divide everything by monetary system and everybody else does it through government system. And so they have both. They have the non-government part and they also have a business. And so through the business, they recruit and train young women who then work in the communities with young girls. So, for example, with that partnership, we would be targeting about 10,000 girls in West Nepal who have the highest rate of sex trafficking. So we would train them, then they develop programs that would teach girls leadership skills. And
so what do you actually teach them? I mean, are you talking about everything from reading and writing to hygiene to, I don't know, what's going on in the world? I mean, what are they actually taught?
Sure. Actually, those specific areas are the things that the local people either do or don't do. We don't try to tell them the issue. So they target an issue generally. Many times it's and actually the issues are, I could broadly categorize them in four areas. They're either in education, they're either in health, or they're trying to create economic opportunities, or their social status. So, for example, the lowest caste system is something that you would hear about in places that have caste. And so for example, in this Nepal group, what we would do is we would go and train them. We don't train them in education and in health practices. That might be part of their program, but generally what we're trying to do is really awaken their potential. And, you know, it's interesting because when we're talking about understanding what leadership is, really at the core of it is three things. It's knowing who you are and understanding yourself and your gifts, and also then being able to connect and communicate with others to be able to form groups. And group leadership is so important. The idea of us doing it alone, the kind of the Lone Ranger syndrome, is really American. Most people around the world are doing things together. And actually, they're generally not likely to do anything by themselves because of such huge cultural pressure. So this idea of getting one girl educated and then she goes to Harvard and then becomes, I don't know, works for Goldman Sachs, is probably never going to happen in Nepal. So you really have to develop collective leadership. And then at the end, it's about taking community action so that they can then either build their community. We also teach advocacy skills so the issue that they're working on also gets worked at the community and national policy. Without this type of, the women are so disengaged with local policies. They don't trust their government. They probably don't even have any interaction with the government. But if they kept at it, then how would their government ever get better? And at the end, we know that the reason why so much of these poverty and injustice exists is because of the corruption in the government. So again, you know, and I also believe that at some point they're all going to go away. So they're either going to die or get kicked out of office. And we really have to generate better leaders and leadership, young leadership in those countries to really create change in their society, or else we would have the same old, and we'd never see change.
Yeah, because even if they aren't going to become the leaders, they need to know how to recognize potentially, who a good leader would be, maybe to throw their support behind.
Right, that's exactly right.
So, I mean, I can imagine this must be incredibly expensive. How are you able to finance this work, Jen?
Right. Well, that's actually the reason why. I mean, I completely understand about the fundraising. That is where we are at right now. It really is about fundraising. Now, because of the model is global model, meaning a global model for local action, that it's really much less costly than most international work. So, for example, the State Department and USAID, they give out huge millions and millions of dollars of grant. And our projects are literally, each project is about $25,000. Now, with that said, that's still a lot of money to raise, but it is literally chump change compared to the way that we've been doing international aid. And this isn't aid. This is literally training trainers. It's like, it would be like teaching our teachers. We know that our students are going to go anywhere without good teachers, so that's exactly the same here. We're training the local trainers. So from that perspective and that ratio, it actually is chump change, but still that takes a lot of fundraising. So that's where we are, to be able to really do those projects. I mean, to reach 500,000 girls, which is my goal in the next 4 years, we'd have to raise significant dollars. But even just for this next year, it would be about $250,000, so $250,000. But, you know, when I present this to people, they're like, God, that's it? I mean, that's just their, you know, that's most people's operation budget. And
right.
So it is. It actually is much less than how much it's costing most organizations. But yeah, we are there at the fundraising part. So I certainly welcome anyone who wants to go to 4GGL.org and be able to contribute. And actually, because of the movement, we also launched a charter membership and membership to really the pioneers who are able to say, okay, this change really is necessary, and this is a global movement, that until we start valuing girls at the fundamental level and being able to invest in them, it is critical. So, and anyone can do that. To join the movement, it's only $10, and to be a charter member, it's only $50. And for most Americans, I don't think that's very much.
No, that's a couple Starbucks visits, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Right. And, that's right. And, in fact, I'm in New York. You can't do anything with $10.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you might not even be able to buy two cups of coffee, huh?
Right. Exactly.
Well, now you've said that you connect with what you're doing and what you're encouraging American women to do with our own spiritual awakening and healing. Why don't you speak to that
right.
a little bit?
Right. And that is what has been so powerful. And, you know, I knew on from the development perspective and from the international work that this is exactly what was needed. I never actually thought that I would get this type of response from the women in America. They all, you know, there's actually a great awakening with women here, which I'm sure to you and to your audience, it's probably a no-brainer. But really, when I go around and present to different people, and especially universities, they're just amazed. And I said, because there's actually a great awakening that's happening with American women that says they get it. They realize that in order to, because they see the interconnection of the injustices, that they really can't fully be awakened and being able to do their potential if others and other countries can't do that. So it's really also with our, you know, perhaps with our own suffering, because we know that this also is a deeply rooted problem everywhere, that they're able to then heal themselves and really see their great potential through the experience. And, you know, go ahead.
Well, now your work, I know you're talking about, you know, going into like maybe third world countries, but do you ever actually work with the people that are living in poverty here in the United States as well?
Oh, yeah, actually that's how I started. So my story is that I was born into a wealthy family in South Korea, and at the age of 7 months old, my father passed away. And literally instantly I became poor because I was a girl. Now, what's interesting is I didn't know the story and nobody told me. And I moved to the United States when I was 8 to meet my mother, because my mother had already left to try to create some sort of economic means for us while I was raised by my grandparents. So through those 8 years, I never knew my father was dead. And what's interesting is, you know, when I tell the story to people, they always say, oh, I'm sorry. And I was like, oh, please don't be sorry. The day that he passed away is the day that it liberated my life. And what do I mean by that? When I came to the United States, it was amazing. These women, all of different ethnicity, they were my mentors. They came into my life and said, well, who said you can't do that? Who said a girl can't do that? They never labeled me by my gender. And they actually didn't even label me by my economic status. I was raised by a single mother, a widow mother, who was an immigrant who couldn't speak English, and she had to start working. So, you know, it's the reality is that her story is probably more dramatic than my story. I mean, only thing I knew was I was poor, whereas with her, she went from literally huge wealth to poverty.
Wow.
So, yeah, so it's quite interesting that, and that's a bigger adjustment than someone who just was poor all their life.
So how does it make you feel, Jen, when you hear all this anti-immigrant hate speech out there? It must really just get to you in a deep place that, you know, it doesn't affect other people.
Well, you know, to me, actually, it doesn't. I've now been able to take everything into a positive energy and really release the things that you wanted to come back. And, you know, America is such a unique and unique country. And I was just talking to somebody who moved from France, and he said, you know, when America stops becoming positive and yes, we can, then the whole world is going to fall apart. And we do have that unique ability to rise above it all. So even if it is racism, even if it is anti-immigrants, I really think at the heart of it all, and for most people, they aren't that way, and they see the opportunity, and that opportunity is the reason why people keep coming to America.
Right.
And really, I'm positive that even if I was raised by my father, if he was still alive and we had billions and billions of dollars, which he did, I would not be liberated if I lived in South Korea with that much money. I mean, it's interesting about money. It comes with so much baggage, and it literally shuts your voice. So when I actually did go back to my birth country as an adult and I saw the life that my cousins lived, I would never dream of it and wish it. You know, they have the chauffeurs and the entourage that goes with them everywhere they go, but they're not able to do anything for themselves.
So
and
what
they
do
can't
they think
even
about you? What do they think,
you know,
about
actually,
you?
Yeah, it's interesting. My aunt, who on my last visit, she has such great memories of my father, and probably, you know, it's funny when people, after people pass away, they become much better than they really were in life. So I'm not really sure if he was this great, but she has such reverence for him, and she said, my gosh, we always knew that he would have a child that would be doing great things. So, and, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I don't see my father's side of the family very much, just for the fact that they're all in South Korea still, but because they're so wealthy and their life is so disconnected from my life, and you know, I don't think they would even know what it would be like to work for people who are poor. So going back to, you know, you had asked, what about the people here? So when I came to America, it's these mentors who took me to the projects of my own neighborhood that I was living. I was poor, and she said, here, you're not going to serve. She never labeled anything. She didn't say these are poor people. She said, you're going to serve your community. And that's where I learned at the age of 8 that I can make an impact in my life, and I can make an impact in this community, and realize all of us can make a difference. So that's actually how I started to work with people and in neighborhoods of poor communities, and to see, really, it doesn't matter if it's Houston or New York or Islamabad or Darfur, they were all women. You know, it was just women, women, and girls. And I thought, something has, I mean, where did we go wrong here? And
right.
I thought, could this really be the reality? And
well, you know,
I got to a point where I was just sick of it.
Well, you know, it makes me think about, you know, oftentimes, you know, a lot of us, you know, people, you know, that are into this, you know, we talk about valuing ourselves, you know, using a new, I don't know, barometer, if you will, you know, instead of how much money we have in the bank, you know, it's sort of like, well, maybe we should value ourselves or empower ourselves by being in service. And here I'm seeing, you know, hearing your story and seeing you in my mind's eye, this 8-year-old little girl being in service to her community. And well, how empowering and powerful that was. I mean, that just speaks volumes. It's incredible.
Right, absolutely. And that's also the reason why 4GGL has become the magic bullet, because UN and every international organization knows that without empowering women and girls, we cannot solve the world's problems. Because it's really, we don't, without addressing women and girls, it's just not possible. But what's empowerment? You can't empower anyone. Empowerment is the power within. So if the UN can do that, my God, I guess, you know, they're better than Allah and Jesus and God and all the other higher powers that we could ever think about. So, and they don't have that solution. That's the reason why we keep doing the same old song over and over again. And, you know, maybe in some communities we might be able to alleviate a little bit of problem to create another problem in another community. So it was like a light that hit me. If we develop their leadership skills and if we develop their leadership potential, whether that be community service or whether that be giving back to their, you know, generally it's always working at the community, to really create some change, that empowers the girl. That empowers the young women. And so that's the reason why it's this model that I've seen it in my own life, but then I've actually been able to do it at the national level and the community level, and then now, of course, international level, is the reason why I started 4GGL, because this really is like the magic bullet, and it really will empower the girls, and it actually empowers the trainers who also may have never recognized that they were disempowered.
You're making the next wave of superwomen, Jen. So for instance, an American woman who wants to get involved, what does that training look like?
Right.
What kind of a commitment does she initially have to make to become a trainer?
Right. That's actually the part exactly. I mean, you must have gotten the notes or the script before. And I know we talked before and we didn't talk about this. You must have been scripted. That's exactly where we are at.
We probably got like about 5 minutes here. So go ahead
sure.
and explain that in case you've inspired any of our listeners out there to, to maybe get involved with your organization.
Absolutely. They can get involved in several ways. Well, first, I'll give you the email address so that anyone can contact me, and that is info@4ggl.org. So that is info@4ggl.org. And anyone can email me or email that address. And that's because we have to clone ourselves. We have to have more global trainers. So what they would do is they would get training here in the United States, but the real experience is going abroad. And by going abroad, and it's in three phases, we do an assessment, building capacity, and co-creation. I call it ABC. And through those experiences, you will certainly be a global trainer, because at the end, for this experience, you know, it's interesting, everyone thinks it's some sort of a, you know, great, like some sort of a business class, and it's not. It's really the cultural part that Americans don't get. You know, with the greatest intention, we can do a lot of harm because we don't understand the culture. And really, in order to really empower them and awaken all of their potential, it is really understanding who they are fundamentally because of their culture. Just the way that we are fundamentally Americans because of our culture. You know, this, yes, you can, you know, what's your problem? Get up, you know, put on your sweat boots and go make something. I mean, that's just not the way that most people are thinking in developing mm-hmm. country. And especially when they're people who've been told all their life they're worth nothing.
Right.
That, you know, to go and get and say, well, you will get an education. It doesn't work that way.
Right, right.
So
yeah.
really,
yeah,
for the women.
Just a totally ahead. Different mindset.
Right, exactly, right. And, you know, what is really great, and I think this is probably the exact reason why I was on the show, is the right brain thinking, that compassionate creativity, that right brain thinking is exactly what 4GGL is recruiting. That's exactly the type of, you know, women that would make a great global trainer. Because they naturally have empathy and they naturally get it. And, you know, in these scenarios where there isn't a clear answer, that right brain has to get kick in to create some creative solutions with the people.
Well, I certainly hope some of our listeners go check out your website and look at the wonderful work you're doing there. I know about Nicholas Kristof and, I forget the guy's name. He's got the book about the teacups.
Greg Mortensen.
Greg Mortensen. But you know what? There are never enough of you out there doing this. I mean, there's a, you know, it's across the globe. I mean, you know, there just aren't enough people reaching all the women and girls out there that need, you know, that need the help. Do you get to Africa, or you're mostly, you know, in like Pakistan and Asia?
Right. Actually, the countries that have asked to partner and to get the training is all across South Asia and Africa. So it's about 16 countries across there. And again, I just started. So I'm fully committed to Africa, and I'm fully committed to even the South America and Latin America.
Sure.
Because I think this is something that can be really it could be anywhere. And in fact, as my colleague says, or my friends say, well, can't this be in America? And I'm like, don't worry, we can do this in America too. But again, I'm committed to one community change at a time. And, you know, it's interesting. Someone just recently asked, well, do you have children? And I said, yes, 600 million of them.
Absolutely.
And 600 million in developing countries. So, you know, I think it's also a unique time where humanity has evolved. We're seeing other children as our own children. And it is time that we think everyone as equal human beings.
Now, if one of our listeners wanted to make a donation to your organization, are you set up that way that maybe they can gift someone something for the holidays by making donation to your organization and make it a meaningful gift instead of a pair of socks or a tie?
Right, absolutely. And that's actually what I encourage. Do it in the name of someone. Do it in the name for your mother or your father. I mean, they really don't need another tie or a sock. So they could actually go to that website, 4ggl.org, and it's just right there on every single page they can give. They're also and on that website, there's also an address if they wanted to send a check. I mean, nowadays I know most people would probably be doing everything online, but if it's a, you know, if it's some sort of a gift or something that they wanted to also send a check, that's also possible. You know, I think it just – it to me, inequity, whether it's gender, whether it's economic inequities, that if we just shared a little bit of what we have, it's so obvious that it would make the world better. And it really has become all about me for so long that it's time that Americans wake up and start to think it's about we. Because by bettering other people, and again, with this work, it's like you see it come back to you in multiple folds. And when I tell people, you know, especially with our goal of how much we're trying to raise, it's $4 per girl.
That's
and people
nothing.
Are like, are you kidding me? Right, exactly. I'm like, that
nothing.
Really is less than a cup of coffee.
So you need money, and you need American women to be teachers, right?
Right, exactly.
And
that's
what
correct.
Kind of a last question, and then we're going to get on to Selena because I see her phone number on the switchboard. What kind of a time commitment or would an American woman need to make in order to be one of these teachers, Jen?
Right. You know, that's very interesting because I've heard people say, well, I'm willing to give money and I'm willing to, you know, give contacts to you, but with Americans, the greatest challenge is time. So what we have done is we've put it in different levels. You know, you can actually help to raise funds, and so you can become a Sophia, and that's very little time. You know, maybe you have a tea party with your friends, or maybe you have a small gathering, or you can actually put a little more time and become a global trainer, or you can just go abroad and have this experience that's also transformative. So we do it at all levels. You can give as little as time as you want, or you can give as much time as you want. And what I have seen that there are people who might say, well, you know, I don't have very much time, but I tell you, this really is infectious. I know people that, I mean, it's like the eat, pray, love
mm-hmm.
of real compassionate work. Being able to go to Nepal and India and go to these places to really touch the lives of girls, even if it's one girl, it is so transformative in your own life that, I tell people, it is eat, pray, love, the humanitarian version.
You're giving me goosebumps. I know. I mean, I can hear your passion, and it's such important work, and I feel better tonight knowing you're out there doing it, so thank you. We're going to have to wrap it up now, but please give your website one more time.
Sure. So it is the number 4ggl.org, and that's 4 Girls Global Leadership. So 4ggl.org, and anyone can contact info@4ggl.org.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for taking your time to tell listeners about your work in the world. I'm sure there's got to be some out there that you got those wheels turning in their head. So thank you so much for being on the show and for the good work you're doing to change the world.
Oh, thank you. It really is. It's an humbling experience. I never in my entire life. I went to medical school and I thought that was hard. And I'm like, wow, this is truly, hard work, but it is so rewarding. It
so
really
rewarding.
Is the gift that gives up, right? It's the gift that keeps coming back.
Absolutely, and to know that you're really one of the players changing the world. I mean, what could be more important?
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, listen. Well, you have a great holiday season, and best of luck with your fundraising. I hope you get what you need to succeed and do your work. Thank you so much, Jen.
Thank you, Karen. And
good
happy
night.
Holidays to you too.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just will save the world with people like Jin In. Yes, you've been listening to Jin In and hearing about her inspirational work for girls and women around the world. So thank you, Jin, for truly being a way shower. And we have another way shower waiting on the line. Let me say hello to Selena Fox. Selena,
hello.
Are you there?
Yes, great to hear your voice again.
Oh, same here. I'm so glad you're back on the show, and I'm excited about seeing you next month at the Pagan Conference. You and Patrick as keynote speakers. Wow, what a double feature.
It's going to be great.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. And, Selena Fox needs no introduction. I'm sure our listeners, know who you are, at Circle Sanctuary. You and your folks were the ones that single-handedly took on the Veterans Administration to make sure we got pentagrams on Wiccan soldiers' graves, and you got the Lady Liberty League and all the incredible work you do for interfaith awareness. What is the most important thing you're doing these days, Selena? And I don't know how you find the time to do it all, but what's your pet project these days?
There are so many different facets. One of the things that we've been doing over the last few months is expanding the structure of Circle Sanctuary, the nonprofit organization, so that more people are involved in anchoring the organization, which will allow me to go out and travel more and have the organization continue on once the time comes that I'm no longer alive. I plan to be around for a while, but you never know once you're up in your elder years. So it's been very exciting. Our Green Cemetery Project has just made another milestone. We got 20 acres now of our 200 that's zoned for cemetery use. And we are one of the first of the green cemeteries in America, and we are a national pagan cemetery, which means that we have people in nature religion from throughout the country that have cremains and memorial stones at our cemetery. With our expansion into 20 acres, we can now do full body burials, and we're very much part of the cutting edge of natural burial in America.
Wow. So what does that
mean?
An
old concept, but in a new form.
Everything old is new again.
Correct.
So tell listeners who may not have heard about that what that means.
Natural burial is pretty much taking the body without embalming, without a steel casket, without a liner, without all that cement and metal that typically goes in the ground in many of the cemeteries in America and other parts of the world. It's pretty much returning the body back to the earth in a shroud, in a wicker basket, in a pine box. And this method of burial is really the oldest form of burial on the planet, natural burial.
Wow.
What's different is that we're intentionally keeping alive this very ancient practice with the conservation of green space.
Okay. So now, so if someone wanted to be buried there at Circle Sanctuary, how would one go about it? And is the cost comparable to what you would find at your local cemetery, or is it much less?
It's much less. And what we're doing right now is case by case as people make arrangements with us. We've done cremains burials for 15 years, and there are people who have indicated that they want natural burials, so we haven't done a natural burial yet since going through the zoning hoop in June of this year, but we have some support resources lined up. So anyone that's really interested in finding out about that way of going back to Mother Earth can contact us either through our website, www.circlesanctuary.org, or emailing us, circle@circlesanctuary.org.
Okay. Well, that was sort of off track from what we plan to talk about tonight, but I think that's really interesting, and what a wonderful opportunity. But just to sort of shift gears to the season, you were going to talk about the Yuletide goddesses and a bit about how to work with them before we talk a little bit more about the pagan studies and the community building speech that you're going to be giving at the conference.
Yes, and, you know, Yuletide is here, depending on how long you celebrate Yuletide. I'm of the tradition that you celebrate it for multiple days and multiple nights. And that is something that ancient peoples did, different cultures, different parts of the world. And part of the reason was that the solstice itself, while there is a solstice point, it actually appears that the sun in its so perceived journey along the horizon line in any given place as it rises and sets during the course of the year gets to a point where it goes up in the same spot for 3 to 4 days. That's why many solstice festivals actually lasted for several days rather than just the single day of solstice.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be setting at one point on the horizon. It'd be rising at one point in the horizon. And the word solstice literally means sun, that's the solstice, stand still, sun stand still. So it appears that the sun is rising at the same point on the horizon rather than moving along the horizon, which it happens, appears to happen during the course of the year. And many people know of Yuletide gift bringers in male forms, principally Santa Claus, the man, right, the elf,
mm-hmm,
the
mm-hmm.
saint, the multicultural international interfaith being who's really a complex amalgamation of different cultures and cultural traditions connected with solstice and then with Christmas laid on top of solstice. But before there was Santa, there were goddesses that
Imagine.
Were bringing gifts. In fact, a number of years ago for BeliefNet, I wrote an article. We have a link to it up at our website under my Yuletide materials that we make available for people year-round. But pretty much talked about Holda and how she, this ancient Teutonic goddess, was a gift bringer in ancient times. And I pretty much in my article and the research that I've done on her really trace a lot of that gift bringing customs to her, like predating Santa, complete to flying through the air
wow.
and bringing gifts. So I think if more people could take a look at the gift bringing and gift-giving customs and actually break out of the gender roles that too often are portrayed as a male gift giver, and actually recognize that it depends on the culture and it depends on the time period, that there are actually goddess forms connected with this holiday as well. So Holda's one of them.
Okay.
And another one, Ops, O-P-S, which gives us our word opulent. The Roman goddess of plenty was celebrated at this time of year. People know of the Saturnalia, and yes, there was the male god of agriculture who merged with the ancient Greek god Kronos, also a god of agriculture but of time. So you have the Saturn-Kronos kind of interplay because the Roman civilization overlaid the old Greek one. But here again, you know, certainly Saturn was honored in ancient times, but Ops was as well. And many people will have during the holiday seasons the exchange of oranges and apples and other fruits. That's really more of an Ops operation rather than a Saturnalia one.
Wow, okay.
Now, we have an Italian witch that is goddess-like in some tales, certainly divine feminine in others, La Befana or Befana, which some people have theorized is actually an older goddess form transformed and woven into some Christian Christmas mythology in later years. But she brings gifts to children at this season. And she, even to this very day, in parts of Italy, you'll see La Befana images in the country marketplaces, and children really expecting gifts from La Befana, even more than St. Nicholas or Santa.
Well, that gives us hope. And, you know, and it's up to us to revive, you know, these goddesses for Yuletide and sort of resist that that temptation to fall into the old habits of only see it as, you know, sort of a, you know, the time of a male deity or male saint or gift giver.
Yes, and then, of course, if we go to Japan, Amaterasu, the sun goddess, has a whole legend connected with her and winter solstice, that she was asleep in a cold, remote cave, and other deities woke her up, loud celebration, and she you know, saw herself in a mirror, and they finally convinced her to come forth and shine her light again. Now, that's one version of the story. Another version, which is a more contemporary adaptation, is that she goes and has her personal space in the cave, and then on winter solstice day, it is her inner drive that brings her out rather than being coaxed out by others and shines her light. In Sweden, we've just had a holiday called Santa Lucia's Day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Saint Lucia or Santa Lucia has her roots in Christian lore in Sicily as well as Scandinavia. But if you strip away the Christian layer of this divine feminine form, you're going to see Lucina from the Roman pantheon, a goddess of light and protector of children and blesser of childbirth. And you're also going to see the sun goddess prevalent in some European countries. Even to this day, there are Santa Lucia celebrations and processionals. And yes, she is seen as a Christian saint. That's one of her faces. But she truly is a pagan sun goddess as well. And she's merged into this folk figure that appears in pop culture, not only in Scandinavia, but in other parts of the world that have heavy Scandinavian influence, including nearby to where Circle Sanctuary is, the village of Mount Horeb, where not only can you go and get Lucy crowns, yes, candle crowns that young women can wear when they're playing this character on St. Lucy's Day, but images of her, I mean, it's amazing. It's a whole section of one of the Scandinavian shops there is Lucy's area. And many people are aware of some of the things connected with this. They may have seen the image of the young woman who represents Lucia with a crown of lit candles, or in contemporary times, they've been battery operated due to fire codes and things.
Yeah. A little bit safer than the smell of burning hair.
That's right, that's right. So you might be familiar with that image, but some of the other images in the entourage people may also be familiar with. Nissa or Tomte, these were Scandinavian nature spirits that watch over different parts of the fields, the house, the barn, that type of thing. So a very colorful procession. And yes, the goddess is alive and well at Yuletide in a number of different cultures across a wide range of faith traditions, and very often is a hybrid of different traditions, Christian and pagan most notably.
Well, I mean, a pagan definitely, if they would just do a little bit of homework, they would see that there's a lot of richness for them too, and they wouldn't have to go along with the traditional Christian Christmas, if you will. They don't have to feel left out in the season. I guess that's my point. You know, they wouldn't have to feel like it's a hollow holiday.
Yeah, my approach to the what I call Yuletide, I like that as an overall term for the holiday, because Yule actually was originally a pagan term meaning wheel, the wheel of the year, or the sun wheel, some say. But it's been adopted also with both secular Christmas and religious Christmas. Yes, there's two branches of Christmas. And I really see this whole holidays season, rather than holiday singular, is something that isn't just uniquely contemporary. If you go back in time and space to different cultures, you'll know that not only was solstice celebrated over several days, but sometimes there was a series of holidays. In ancient Rome, for example, the month of December started out with the honoring of Bona Dia, the good goddess. And this was a form of the divine mother that was honored by women in an all-women's event. How do we know about this, since it was a mystery religion and there was quite a bit of secrecy around it? One year, a man dressed as a woman snuck into the rites, and it made the history books, this scandal, and it happened more than once over a period of time, but the one that's probably most famous is when Caesar's wife and mother were hosting it, and this guy snuck in, and there was big speculation as to whether he was actually having an affair with Caesar's wife, etc. So, sometimes human behavior really doesn't change, in that there were sex scandals back then. Well, this certainly was one. But the good thing that came out of all the hullabaloo around that particular incident is the fact that Bonadea, as a form of the divine feminine, was preserved in the history books because of the scandal. People came to understand that yes, there was a whole honoring of the bountiful harvest and the good goddess and Lady Luck, and she had many different faces. And then later on in the month, you had Ops being celebrated. You had the Saturnalia on the 17th and the 18th. Then you had Ops on the 19th and the 20th of December. And then people would be continuing their celebration even as the calendar year changed. So there was like another few days at New Year's. So it seemed like pretty much one big party for much of the month of December. Another form of the goddess at Yule is Isis or Aset. And in fact, many of the images that we have of divine mother and divine child have some of their archetypal forms in art and sculpture, paintings from images that date back to old Egypt.
Ah, well, you know, being an Isis person myself, I didn't know she had these connections in December.
Yes, and I have a reproduction of a fairly famous image of her nursing Horus, and I have also my collection a Mother Mary figure nursing Jesus, and many parallels being drawn between that whole divine mother and sun child, S-U-N and S-O-N.
Absolutely.
And so one of the things that I encourage people to do in the holidays season is to celebrate more than one day, stretch out the celebration over a period of time, rather than having the big crescendo and then the letdown, actually do the, what I call the time release solstice and holiday season. And that way you have a chance to spread the holiday cheer out a bit more.
Yeah.
And also incorporate into the celebration some traditions and customs from the past, personal past, ancestral past, and a way of learning about this holiday's time. It's a window to our past and also to the multifaceted nature of the holiday, and a way that we can even consider shaping our celebrations for years to come.
Absolutely.
So one of the things, one of the things I would encourage your listeners to do is to take a few moments out sometime during this month and do some research, be it in the internet or a library or some encyclopedias that one might have access to, having to do with holiday traditions from a particular ancestral culture that one might know. I happen to have a rich tapestry of ancestry, so every year I get to pick one of those and do some more research into it. And with my Swedish ancestry, I've come to know quite a bit about Lucia, Lucina, Santa Lucia, and some of the traditions connected with that, my Swedish heritage. But I also have gotten to know from my Germanic side the Holda lore, or Fra Hola. And that's part of how I've discovered the Yuletide goddesses, was doing some research into holiday traditions and then taking them back even further.
So now tell me, Selena, did you break down and buy one of those crowns with the candles on them?
Absolutely. We use it every year in our winter solstice pageant. We have a young woman who represents the goddess of light that comes down the aisle in a Unitarian church that we co-create our pageant with every year.
Mm-hmm.
We have a winter solstice pageant this year. It's on coming up on Friday night, and we have a whole host of gods and goddesses and other Yuletide figures that are there in costume, and we share lore and a bit of their life, and we have music and storytelling. And every year we have some of the same characters played by different people, and we have new characters.
Well, I wish I were closer. I would love some year to take part in some of your pageants there at there in Wisconsin. Well, Selena, for people who might not really know how to utilize the energies of these goddesses, how could they sort of tap in? And aside from maybe the storytelling, or taking on these new traditions, do you have some ideas for listeners on, how these goddesses or their attributes could sort of enhance the season?
Yes, and I have some suggestions up on the Circle Sanctuary website. You can go to the main page at www.circlesanctuary.org, and you click on the Celebrating the Seasons, and
okay,
there's information on creating winter solstice celebrations for families and households, and there's information about, I have the 13 ways to celebrate pagan Yuletide. There's some information in there. But in addition to that material, one of the things that I've been teaching this holiday season is doing some journaling. And as a technique for journaling, to actually pick a Yuletide character, for example, one of these Yuletide goddesses, and to do a creative visualization in which one imagines that they are being visited by the Yuletide character or goddess, having an encounter, having a dialogue, and then journaling about the experience.
Mm. Well, and this is the time of the season where we go within, and so that's a perfect exercise.
Yeah, last night I did my Yuletide journaling workshop test drive, brand new workshop I just created, and the particular Yuletide goddess that I had people have a visit with, it was a visit with Lucina or Lucia, and I had amazing dreams myself after the evening. That was kind of a side effect. I hadn't really encountered a thought that it would actually creep into my dreams, but it did. In addition to the visualization that I did and other people did, and journaling about that, I actually had a wonderful dream, and it continued on in that level. So certainly one could do some meditation work. One
mm-hmm.
could do some journaling. I think another thing that would be a fun thing to do is some research, which is a good segue into what I call the pagan studies aspect of tonight as well. There's even more information available than ever before through internet research. Of course, not everything out on the internet is accurate or helpful, so you have to check your sources. But a wonderful thing to do at Yuletide is some research into old-style paganism, contemporary paganism, into some of the faces of the divine. There's a whole wealth of images that are available for personal use on the internet, and one could pick one of the Yuletide goddesses I mentioned, or perhaps some other ones that I haven't really gone into, such as Spider Woman, and download an image of that face of the divine feminine, put it on an altar or on a Yuletide table as an additional image for the season.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I bet you would also find lots of wonderful recipes, old recipes that you can incorporate into your menus for the holidays, and then even make some offerings to those goddesses on your altar of these newfound foods from days long ago.
Yes, there's something called Lucia cakes, and we actually had some last night because one of the people who took part in the workshop last night has Swedish ancestry, and he's a really good cook. He's one of our naturalists, and he's been making Lucia cakes for years, and he experimented with some additional seasonings. We got to try both kinds last night, and I have my main page on Facebook, which is my fan page. Actually, you can see him and the Lucia cakes and a number of comments about it, including a link that I posted for one of these recipes. So, yes, you can actually make some traditional foods connected with this. And when do you go and give a winter solstice goddess an offering, and how do you do that? Well, some will go on January 5th or 6th for Fra Hola or Hole or La Befana. That's a time for giving offerings. Some will give an offering on Solstice Eve or Solstice Day, and some on Christmas Eve, which in old Germany and some other parts of Europe is called Mother Night or Mother's Night. So you have the Great Mother as an archetype of the divine feminine pretty much hardwired into the winter solstice holiday season.
How delicious. Well, Selena, we probably have about 10-15 minutes at the most left. We want to talk about the pagan studies a bit. What did you want to share with listeners? Was it about the upcoming conference or just, pagan studies in general?
I think both. Let me begin by talking about the conference, because this is the 7th annual conference, and its focus is called Building Community. It's going to be January 22nd and 23rd. And as you mentioned before, I'm one of the keynote speakers, and Patrick McCollum, who's another Circle Sanctuary minister and someone who, like myself, has done quite a bit of work in interfaith settings, we're both going to be at this conference. It's going to be held at Claremont Graduate University. That's in Claremont, California, at 10th Street and Dartmouth Avenue. There's a Facebook page for it, and you can get more information at paganconference.pashamusic.com, or you can put Conference on Current Pagan Studies 2011 and Google it, and it will take you right to the page.
Okay.
Besides presentations that I'm going to be doing and Patrick's going to be doing, there will be people presenting a variety of different papers, and there will be a community ritual on Saturday night, which I'll be facilitating. And it's a wonderful opportunity to explore the realm of pagan studies and to connect with other people that are interested in exploring not only paganism as a whole, but some of the aspects of it, and certainly goddess spirituality is part of that.
And I'm not sure if you said it or not, but the theme this year is building community.
Yes, and I'm actually, in my keynote, I'm going to be talking about ways that pagan rites of passage can help build community. And this is going to come not only from my direct experience in facilitating rites of passage and teaching people about facilitating rites of passage, but also from my conversations and experiences with other people that are involved in this work. It's a really exciting time in the realm of pagan studies, which is a form of academia, but yet it even extends beyond the campus realm of studies. It's made its way into popular culture. In fact, part of how we come to know what we know about goddess forms is by people who have a real interest in ancient pagan cultures doing research in those areas and bringing forth information about goddesses and other forms of the divine feminine, as well as other forms of divine masculine as well, and even going beyond gender, bringing that information into the here and now. Pagan studies as a field is still fairly new in terms of that phraseology. But if you go back far enough in time, you actually go into ancient pagan cultures, there was pretty much that was the way of studying and gathering information at the time. And it's really exciting to see in academia that there is not only recognition given to the validity of this form of academic research, but some very innovative work is being done right now. It's really exciting.
And for listeners who might not know, I know at the American Academy of Religion, goddess studies is now one of the topics that's accepted and is part of the annual conference. And, you know, pagans are also are doing their part at the Parliament of World Religions as well.
That's right. And I really think it's very important to be able to have a wider range of expression for people looking at the realm of spirituality and consciousness, looking in the arts, looking in the different facets of life, and being able to have nature religion take its place equally alongside other forms of religion and spirituality and philosophy. We certainly had more than 1,600 years of bad PR. After the Roman Empire fell, not that I'm an advocate of all that old Rome once was, it certainly had had some practices that were problematic, but certainly there were some good things in that culture as well. But as Christianity took over Europe, some of the old wisdom ways of the pagan religion became anathema, became invisible, became ridiculed, became forgotten. And what's happening now in present day, not only America, but other parts of the world, people are looking about reclaiming some of that wisdom and going into ancient texts and doing translations and making the material more available. And really, in the cyber age, it's fabulous that material that would be pretty much in a very narrowly controlled realm in a particular academic or other institution of learning can now be made more widely available. And with translation software available on the internet, it allows us to even get more access. So I really see a tremendous revolution is happening in the whole way that studies are done to begin with. And pagan studies as a whole is growing by leaps and bounds. Yes, it's now a recognized part of the American Academy of Religion. And I was among those back in 1995 that helped birth the Nature Religion Scholars Network that is now evolved into the Contemporary Pagan Studies group that's meeting regularly as part of the Parliament of the World's Religions, or part of the American Academy of Religion. And you mentioned Parliament of the World's Religions, and there's also research and studies and papers that are being done through that large interfaith conference, which I have taken part in a number of times since it was revived in 1993. In addition to being at the conference on current pagan studies, I'm also going to be in that general area. I'm going to be doing a workshop at Practical Magica on Thursday, January 20th. Doing a home blessing magic workshop. So I'm going to talk about ways of taking some of this old lore and having very practical adaptations for doing blessings for one's home. And that'll be in the evening. And then at the Green Man store in North Hollywood, California. I'm doing Green Man, Green Gods workshop. Yes, I'm using a lot of Green Man forms, but certainly as part of that talk, I'm going to talk about, well, not all green men are green men. There's actually green women as well. And in fact, I often will call my workshop these days the Green Ones, because some you can't even tell the gender. The foliage
well, yeah,
in the face.
I was thinking about all those green witches out there.
That's right. So I'm really looking forward to being able to visit California in January. I'll be back in a different part of California in February, San Jose, for PantheaCon, February 18th to 21st. And it's wonderful to know that there's many opportunities for people who are interested in the divine feminine, in nature religion, in paganism, to be able to come together and meet each other, share ideas, and learn.
Absolutely. Well, and I'm glad you're going to be able to get out of Wisconsin in the dead of winter and actually come here to California and see some real green growth still alive.
California in the winter sounds good to me.
Well, Selena, I did have I had a couple people that emailed me some questions. I want to try to get them in real quick before the show, before the show ends. One asked, considering the current, you know, economic downturn that so many are suffering from, as a minister, what do you tell your congregation? You know, any words of hope for them, or how they can cope with the suffering, quite frankly, that's going on around the country?
Well, and not a day goes by where I'm not giving someone some support around that. So that is definitely a pertinent question. I think taking the view that life has its ups and downs and cycles, you know, on a real intellectual, cosmic level, one can understand that things can change, and very likely what's economically challenging now can shift into a better reality. Okay, that's one approach. But I think what's perhaps an even more relevant approach for people that are really struggling is to look at what one does have and to celebrate that rather than having the depression of lack be so prominent. Also, having some networking regarding community resources. And one of the things that we do at this time of year, which is our own way of being a Labafana or a Holda or one of the other gift bringers at this time of year, is we keep alive the idea of charity and community sharing. We do a charity food drive, and I was on the phone with the local food pantry, which is housed at a nearby Lutheran church. Yes, it's an interfaith food pantry, and our church is one of the contributors to it. And I did some networking and talked with the staff of the church and the food pantry to just find out what the needs were in the area and what other resources that there might be available. So if one is in a position of helping others who are struggling economically, is to help not only by providing words of comfort, but to get on the internet and also get on the phone and actually talk to some other people who are involved in problem solving at this economic time. And it's amazing the kinds of things that are coming together to help those who are in need. And I learned about an expansion of a free clothes closet in our local area, and am certainly looking into ways that we can also contribute to that, to those who are in need. And so there are sometimes resources that aren't really even that available on the internet, but by calling around to some local areas and, you know, Chamber of Commerce and human resources centers and mental health centers, often there'll be social workers and other personnel there that have some ideas about what else to do. And I see that economically challenging times can be an opportunity for us to really draw together closer with each other and really look at what goes beyond the material. Yes, we need basic needs met, but we can also go beyond that as well and look, especially at this holiday time, at what we can offer each other in terms of companionship and really getting at core values of what's important in life. Love and caring and support and working together. Some good things can come out of economically difficult times as well as the challenges.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, that. I mean, I don't mean to be flippant, but it's like, you know, try whatever ways you can to make lemonade of lemons. You know, if you're unemployed and you have a skill, volunteer. You know, help people who need your skill who don't have money, you know. I know I was reading an article, I think a fellow by the name of Eisenberg, who's going to be on the show next month, about circle giving, you know, circles of people getting together and say, I have this to donate or I have this service I can provide and I need such and such. I mean, you know, actually, you know, he talked about the psychological boon of you know of you know this interconnectedness, you know, helping one another, you know, through this, you know, this old idea of bartering in a way, you know, and
well,
and we've become so disconnected, this reconnects us.
Exactly. And if there are some events that one might want to go to or something that one might really like to have but there's limited resources, it does not hurt to have direct communication and ask, because while many places don't put the big advertisement, we'll have a certain number of things that we give away for free. Sometimes people will have that built into their structure for an event. There may be scholarships and things.
Mm-hmm. So, or volunteer in exchange for your admission or something like
that's
that.
That's right. And so it is a real opportunity to muster our creative resources. But I think the really important thing is to get out and to connect with others and not let economic depression cause psychological depression.
Yeah.
Reaching out and connecting, I think it is so important. And sometimes when folks are feeling really limited financially and in other ways, there's a tendency to just pull inward due to being concerned about spending anything to get anywhere. And I would suggest reaching out and doing what you can to connect with others and having within one's consciousness that there is kindness and there's generosity in the world. And when one has received a favor or a help, to let that encourage one to do more of that, to give to the larger universe.
Absolutely. Reciprocity.
Right.
I mean, you think about the flower. It doesn't grow without the water and the sun. So... well, Selena, one last question, and we got like 5 minutes.
Okay.
Someone said that do you have any thoughts on 2012, the paradigm shift, what might be ahead for us?
I'm part Native American and travel in some Native American circles, and while I was not culturally raised Native American, certainly it's part of guess my spiritual fabric of ways of being. And so I've made a point in talking with elders and members of a number of different tribes to get a sense of what some people call the Mayan prophecies. And I I think that rather than the world is coming to an end in 2012, as some have interpreted it, I think it is an opportunity for us to shift our thinking to be more global in our outlook and more connected with the larger circle of life. Anytime you get a large group of people all expecting something, things do tend to happen. But I actually think that a good take on 2012 is, okay, there's a lot of concern and angst. What can we do to bring more love and optimism, more collaboration, and more possibility for a sustainable world into being? Because you can get caught up in the angst of destruction, or you can take concern about destruction and let it be a catalyst for bringing about a consciousness of vision of not just whether there's going to be a 2013, but where are we going to be in 2113? Mm-hmm. Where are we going to be a millennium from now? And what can we do in our day-to-day life, not only to nurture ourselves in our spiritual path, but to be part of the solution to sustaining life on this planet and beyond? So I think that it's an opportunity to be visionary and to reach out and dialogue and connect. What kind of world do we want to bring in together?
Yeah, and try to make that world what we want it to be.
Yes, and I may sound like I'm stuck in the 60s. I was a peace activist then and have continued to be. But I do think harmony and peace, a sustainable world where not only humankind gets along better with each other, but with the larger circle of life, I do think that that is possible. And you may call me a dreamer, but I am not the only one to quote someone who is now in the other world, but whose legacy and concepts continue to be here. I really think at this holiday time, this is a time not only to think about peace, but to actively work for greater peace within, as well as greater peace around in our local area, as well as the planet and beyond, holding the vision of peace and adjusting our lifestyle so that we are agents of peace and change. Isn't that a universal Yuletide message?
Oh, absolutely. And you know what? I don't care if it sounds hokey, you know, about the 60s, because you, peace, harmony, love, I mean, how can anybody knock that, quite frankly? You know, I think that should be all of our mantra, you know, across the globe.
And if you go back across cultures and through time, you'll find that in solstice celebrations in many parts of the world, it was not only a time to take a break from normal activities, but there was a real focus on peace. Wars would stop, the courts would shut down, people would try to do reconciliation to prepare for the new solar year. So whatever one's religion, philosophy, spirituality, or viewpoint is, it's my yes, Yuletide wish that we find ways of making peace within as well as peace in the world that we live in. And by doing so, we help bring about that what we wish for.
Well, Selena Fox, thank you so very much. We have like about 2 minutes left, so I'm going to have to wrap it up, but I can't imagine ending the show on a more positive note. I thank you so very much for your wisdom, you who are our elder, our mentor, and you know, thank you so very much for the hard work you do every day and have done for years. you know, Goddess bless you and thank you.
Well, many Goddess blessings to you and all your listeners. Thanks again for all of your work and for doing this show and having me on it again.
Well,
happy holidays, whatever you celebrate.
Thank you. Well, you're welcome back anytime, and we look forward to seeing you at the Pagan Conference. And listeners, any of you out there who want to get specifics on that or those classes Selena is giving at those local shops, you just email me, and I'll make sure you get the details. Well, Selena, thank you very much. You have a wonderful holiday season, and thank you for enriching ours.
And enjoy the season. Have a great night.
Good night, Selena. Well, listeners, we're about ready to come to a close. We only have about 60 seconds left. So I want to thank you for tuning in tonight, and I hope you'll be back with us next week. We have on the show Nina Simons from Bioneers. She's going to be talking about her book Moonrise that has to do with women's leadership, the power of women leading from the heart. And our second guest next week is going to be Margaret Barker, and our theme is The Lost Lady, talking about the Israelite goddess. So, if I might, just a quick closing prayer. Hail Goddess, full of grace, blessed are you, and blessed are all the fruits of your womb, for you are the mother of us all. Hear us now, heal us now, and in all our needs and dreams, and in all our needs and dreams. O blessed be, Ashi. That was adapted from Carol Christ, and we thank her. Well, good night, listeners, and please tune in next week.